Hannah actually went to the Swiss Libri when she was in college, and we've gone to the conference for now how many years?
13 years
we've been going every year to the conference, and we love it, and it's become part of our life. So the chance to be able to speak here and then at the conference is just a really big privilege for me, and thank you, Jack, for thinking of me and our story. So yeah, I'm gonna try to get this picture up. Oh, it already went dead here. So this is an aerial picture of our farm, and I'm gonna do a slideshow of pictures after I'm done with kind of the intro story here, but I'm just gonna leave this up, and then when it goes black, I'm just gonna let it go black, because otherwise I gotta like keep pressing shift according to Jerome. So just to get, I know a few of you in the crowd, some good friends are here, but just to get a little bit of feel for who's here, how many, raise your hand if you're a native Minnesotan in the crowd. About half. Okay, how many people have their grandparents or somewhere back not that far ago have a farm in the family? Raise your hand. Okay. And who's on a farm now, farming or just living on a farm, hobby farm, any kind of farm? Okay, a few, okay. It's good to get kind of a feel. Well, part of our story is that I'm a native Minnesotan, and my voice kind of gives it, my accent gives it away. I'm told it's getting stronger all the time. I don't think it used to be this bad, but it seems to be getting worse. But my oldest ancestors in this area are from the area around Millville, where our farm is just 5 miles. We're between Zumbro Falls and Millville. And my oldest ancestors came from Norway and homesteaded around the 1850s. And our farm now is just about 5 miles from where that original homestead was. So it's, you know, it's kind of, a lot of my story is going back to some roots that, you know, in some ways in my childhood I wasn't as connected to. But yeah, my oldest boys are 12 and 10 now, and they just started working on their chainsawing skills. They've got a little DeWalt chainsaw that, you know, you got to get them to cut your firewood for the winter because I'm really sick of it. But, you know, part of as a miller, you know, when I was growing up, my dad taught me how to use a chainsaw. And part of the rite of passage for that was we always got this Scandinavian joke with Sven and Oli with the chainsaw, and I'm just gonna share that with you because I've just told it to the boys and it's just great. Okay, so Oli's the Norwegian, Sven's the Swede. You know, Oli's kind of the, you know, the out of touch Norwegian, and Sven is the up to date Swede. You know, and Oli's, you know, he's very proud of how much firewood he can cut with his handsaw. And Sven comes over one day with a chainsaw, and he says, "Oli, you know, you got to get with the times. This, you know, this old handsaw that you have, you know, this chainsaw can cut 10 times what you can cut with this handsaw." So he says, "I'll leave it here. You know, I'll come back tomorrow. You tell me how much you love it. You know, it'll be great." So Sven comes back the next day, and Oli's still sitting there with his handsaw. You know, the chainsaw is sitting over to the side, and he says, "You know, Oli, what's the problem here? You know, this chainsaw is amazing." And Oli says, "Oh, it's a piece of garbage. I can cut 10 times as much with my old handsaw. You know, it's a piece of garbage." So Sven's all confused. He picks it up. You know, he just doesn't know what. So he starts it up and he vroom 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 vroom. And Oli jumps back and he says, "What's that noise?" that's the joke that my dad told me and I just told my boys. And, thought I'd start out with that. But yeah, so as far back as my childhood, back in my childhood, I've always considered myself through and through a city boy, and that came mostly from spending the golden years of my childhood in inner city Minneapolis, and it really was a great place to grow up. It was a pretty poor neighborhood, but it was safe, and all the kids in the neighborhood were in the same boat, and there's just a ton of kids, and there was these amazing city parks within walking distance of our place, and it was really great. The love of the city also came from my mom, who, she grew up in Detroit, and when she was growing up in the 1960s, all the white people in Detroit were starting to move out to the suburbs, and it was becoming real, you know, just almost completely a black city, and her parents resisted that, and she stayed, and always was really in love with the city. She stayed there till she was 30 in Detroit. She was a printer and a drug rehab. She worked at a drug rehab clinic, and she was a community organizer. And in 1968, when she graduated high school, there was a huge race riot in Detroit. And she was right there in the city when it happened. She considered herself a Marxist revolutionary at the time. And my dad also had been in the big city working as a reporter in Washington, D.C. for the Associated Press in the 1960s. He reported on the civil rights movement, the Poor People's Campaign, and the Vietnam War. So I kind of figured I would be like my parents and do these big things in a big city somewhere. That's kind of my identity, of what I thought my identity was. But when my dad finished seminary in Minneapolis during those golden years of my childhood, his first job as a pastor was down in rural Minnesota, where I went to high school. And when I graduated high school, as soon as I could, I went back to Minneapolis for college because I wanted to get out of there as soon as I could. I saw that just as a stepping stone to get to an even bigger city like New York or Boston or something like that, work on writing, you know, make it big. That kind of thing. But all these plans came to a pretty abrupt halt when my parents called me one time during college and said that my mom had been diagnosed with an advanced kind of lung cancer. They said that the doctors thought she'd probably only make it a year or two. And so I moved back into their house in Millville, Minnesota, which was population 150. And I wanted to be with them to help in any way I could. I went with my mom to all the doctor's appointments and the chemo and radiation treatments. She only made it a matter of months, and she died in the spring during Holy Week, and she was surrounded by family. And this former Marxist revolutionary, minutes before her last breath, managed to whisper, "God is good." After her death, I was a very grieved, very angry 22-year-old. I still felt like I needed to stay close to my dad and brother, so I set up in the basement of the house, and eventually I figured that I should probably get a job. Back in the late 60s, my dad, after he was the Big Shot reporter in Washington for a while, had a kind of identity crisis and moved back to Minnesota. After a stint with the Minneapolis Star Tribune, he started his own publication, an anti-nuclear power back to the land magazine called the North Country Anvil. The quote on the head of the magazine was by Carl Sandburg, and it said, "This old anvil laughs at many broken hammers. There are still men who can't be bought." It's a great, great masthead line. The idea of the magazine was to fight against the modern technological society that my dad and the group thought was trying to insert itself in nearly every part of modern life. My parents and the group wanted to push back against the professionalization of the culture and called on people to reteach themselves to do just basic things again and take back control of their lives. So they prided themselves not only on publishing the magazine themselves, but they also printed the entire magazine on these old turn-of-the-century presses in this little tiny print shop in Millville. They, of course, heated the print shop with wood, and they cut it with an old handsaw. No, just kidding. They used chainsaws. But the idea, which I still think is a noble one, was to push back against the behemoth corporations that had taken over so much of modern life and all the Kafkaesque bureaucracies that had come to dominate modern life, and to try to find a way forward that was more human and more in tune with nature. Needless to say, this magazine attracted a lot of interesting characters from our area. One of those wonderful characters was Marge Wortheson. She had been a close friend of my mom's. Our family always called her Margo. She was an organic market gardener, and her husband Jack have a beautiful farm near Plainview where they also raise beef cattle and raise crops. I can't remember who approached who first, but I ended up getting a part-time job helping her in the garden and at the farmer's market. Right from the beginning, a few things of the farm lifestyle stood out to me. For one, I had never really eaten such fresh vegetables that were picked and then brought in and cooked for lunch. It was an amazing experience. These farm lunches, which Margo whipped up with it was just amazing how fast she cooked these lunches, but they just blew me away. Partly I think it was I'd never really worked that hard in my entire life, and I was so hungry that it tasted amazing. But she would, whatever she had a ton of in the garden, whether it was a lot of kale or broccoli or cauliflower, whatever it was, she'd picked a bunch of that, you know, brought it in for lunch, and she'd throw in, you know, a big skillet with onions, garlic, and a bunch of finely chopped potatoes, and she'd call it, if it was kale, she'd call it kale gottolata. You know, what are we having, Margo? Well, I think we're having kale gottolata today. It was really an amazing experience getting to taste that kind of fresh food. And those lunches alone would have been plenty to pay me. I mean, I was such a slow, bad worker at the beginning. I felt like the lunches alone were a huge payment, and she still paid me something. But the other thing I noticed right away working outside is that I felt strangely happy a lot. And I was like, what's going on here? I chalked this up to the fact that basically all my time spent during college working at a coffee shop and studying late and being mostly nocturnal was I just didn't spend a lot of time outside or in the sun at all. On the farm, my body responded to the fresh air and the sunshine like a pale, leggy plant that's been pulled out of the shade and put in the light. The farm work was a balm to me, and my skin was absorbing huge amounts of vitamin D from the sun and releasing all this serotonin into my system, which is serotonin, of course, is a natural antidepressant. Andrew Peterson, this is the book I brought tonight, in this his book, The God of the Garden, he also claims that garden soil has a bacteria that once it gets under your fingernails, it also triggers the release of serotonin in your body. It's just this amazing, one of the amazing bacterias that's in garden soil. So I would ask Margo about something like this, and she'd say, well, the world would be a lot nicer place if people got outside and went to bed tired. I was like, okay, all right, that sounds about right. I worked also for an organic dairy farmer that lived down the road from us, and I fell in love with farm work. My body and my mind were being challenged and pushed as they were absorbing all the manual labor and knowledge of plants and growing things. At one point, Margot said, "You know, you could probably do this for real." And I know when she said it, I had the feeling that that was exactly what was going to happen. But being a constant questioner, I decided I needed to have some sort of test to make sure that this was really steering away from my city life. So I told Margot, "I think I want to be a farmer, but first I need to move back to Minneapolis for just a while to make sure that I want to be a farmer." And she kind of looked at me and went back to hoeing onions or whatever and shook her head, and she's muttered what she pretty much said to all my constant questions, which is, "There's nothing to it but to do it. Nothing to it but to do it." And so I did. I moved back to Minneapolis. But this little test didn't last very long. I stayed a few months in a dilapidated duplex in South Minneapolis with my brother and some of his friends, and I got a job at a restaurant/bar. I was forced to spend most of my time again indoors, and I worked late hours serving pretty nasty food and lots of drinks. The last straw during that experiment was when the restaurant that I work at, the head chef, who was a self-proclaimed gutter punk anarchist, was fired for drinking after hours with his buddy and leaving all the doors to the restaurant open. This terrible neighborhood. And the owner came and found all this. And I'm not making this up. Just a few days later, he was then arrested by the FBI because they found a stash of urine-filled water balloons that he planned on throwing at politicians that were coming into town for the Republican National Convention. You can't make that stuff up. But for the first time, my feelings really changed towards the city, and I felt stifled in the city. After spending the time I had in the country with so much potential for good work and small, close-knit community, the city felt crowded and uninviting to me. I craved these big spaces and these big views of the sky. Most of all, I wanted to do something that had the possibility of establishing some deep roots. Roots deep enough, as the famous Bilbo Baggins says, that can't be reached by the frost. My mom's death was also still haunting me, and I wanted to be close to the place that she had made her home and was buried. I was also hungry to reconnect with the faith that I was raised in and wanted to take it more seriously. I was reading a lot of Flannery O'Connor at the time. I was also having these spiritual conversations with the only openly Christian friend I had at the time, who worked with me at the gutter punk restaurant. Her name was Kim. She grew up in southern Indiana in a trailer. She had a strong southern drawl, and she had a big chip missing from her front tooth. We worked in a kitchen cutting up onions a lot, and we'd talk about Flannery O'Connor and all kinds of spiritual matters. She was one of those people whose reactions were so good that it was hard not to poke fun at her. We'd be talking about something really deep, and then I'd say, "But Kim, you haven't told me how you got that chip out of your tooth." She'd turn to me with a big chopping knife, and she'd say, "Dan, if you say you talk about that again, I will cut you." During that time, I would ask Kim's advice if I should move back to the country and be a farmer. She'd always say, "Dan, you know you're supposed to be a farmer. There's nothing for you here." She'd say that all the time. It wasn't long after I moved back to Millville from the big city that I met another young woman who would challenge my faith a lot. While I'd been gone, my old childhood friend Joe and his wife Rebecca had bought a farm just a few miles from Millville. I also found out that Rebecca's sister Hannah was coming for the summer to work on the farm, when I knew that I was going to meet Hannah for the first time, I had worked really hard on steeling myself because I was determined that I was going to try as hard as I could to hone myself and my newfound gardening trade, and I could not be distracted by a pretty young woman. So when I came to the farm, to Joe and Rebecca's farm, and saw Hannah walking up with her farmy plaid button-down shirt and her Carhartt pants, I was so shocked by her beauty that I muttered a curse word underneath my breath. Looking back, I really think I had a vision in that moment, a vision that I was very actively trying to repress, that this would be the person that I would get to know better than anyone else in the world. But that was just the first time I saw her in person. The first time I knew Hannah existed was when I had visited Joe and Rebecca in New York State the fall before, and I'd seen a picture of Hannah on their fridge. There was this young woman there working on Joe and Becca's farm, and she happened to see me staring at the picture of Hannah on the fridge, and she came up to me and said, "She's pretty, huh? Well, forget about it. She's dating a Swedish guy in Sweden." Yeah, but that didn't work out. Hannah and I started dating in the fall, and we were married the next. We shared a vision of starting a farm and having a bunch of kids and working together as a family. Of course, we had no idea how that was all going to happen. For my part, I was still roughly working off of the outline that Margot had made out for me, that first you buy a truck, which I did. That allows you to get a puppy, which you buy from the farmer's market, which I did. And that was a little Frankie. The puppy will attract a good wife, which it did. Then you buy the farm, have the kids, bada bing, bada goon. There you go. That's what Margot said. You know, it's all that simple. So all we had to do was get the farm and have the kids. Well, it just so happened that 30 acres of farmland, literally right next door to Joe and Rebecca's farm, was coming up for sale. The asking price was $115,000. The bank would only loan us $50,000, so we had to come up with $65,000 in a very short time. I still had student loan debt. Thankfully, Hannah had 10 grand in savings from her posh Swedish jobs. But we had no guile, and we saw our farming endeavor basically on the same sort of holiness level as going to seminary or being a missionary or something like that. So we sent out letters to everyone we knew that had money, and we asked them for no interest loans or donations. The money came from some of the unlikeliest sources, and our farm became truly a crowd-funded endeavor. One of the guys that loaned us money told my dad later when we paid him back, "I really can't believe they actually paid me back." I think a lot of people thought that way. So we did come up with the money, and we went into our farm adventure, first living in Millville in my dad's basement, because our land was literally one big cornfield. And we spent all of our money on just buying the land. So we had to, every farming season, we had to save the money we got from vegetables to build something on the farm. First, we had to put in a driveway. We had to get electrical service installed. We had to dig a 400-foot deep well. And then we built a small work shed with a little 400-foot tiny apartment attached to it, and we moved in. Eventually, we had three kids sleeping on one side in one loft, and we were on the other loft on the other side in this tiny apartment. It was a very cozy time, and we still have good memories of literally being able to hear the kids breathing as we went to bed. But it only took 1 year for Hannah to tell me in no uncertain terms that we needed to start building a house. So we started house plans and began construction that fall. I was doing most of the work myself, and I still think it's a miracle but we were able to move in the following fall. Lots of help and things fell into place with that project. We're forever indebted to our friend Bruce, who was a former building contractor and kind of adopted our family and helped us throughout the house build. Bruce was so loud of a guy that Joe and Becca next door said that they could hear pretty much everything that was said on the building site, you know, 40 acres away. It mostly had things to do with his tape measure. He'd say, you know, "Who stole my tape measure? Where's my tape? It's gone. It's gone. Don't even look for it. It's gone." He just yelled that all the time. But Bruce is no longer with us, and we miss him a lot. He taught me a lot about building and was a big reason I was able to get so many building projects done in those few years. But I will say it's a lot quieter on the building projects now. It's very peaceful. When we moved into the new house, we felt like millionaires. The big open floor plan was almost overwhelming compared to our little apartment. Our next child was born in the big house, as our kids called it, and Hannah made it a home with all of her plants and beautiful touches. We saved up for a top-of-the-line wood stove that is the centerpiece of our living room, and we are in our happy place on those long winter evenings with a good fire going. Unfortunately now, the thought of fire is also correlated with the hardest memory of our homesteading journey. Shortly after we knew we were going to have our fifth child, a loose wire on the charger of our all-electric four-wheeler heated up and burst into flames, creating a giant fireball right in the middle of our produce shed. By the time the fire department got there, the building was fully engulfed, and when they got it out, all that was left was a black shell. Leading up to this point in our journey, we felt like we were on the brink of arriving. Things would really slow down, and we would kick back and enjoy the life that we'd worked so hard to make. Financially, we were in a great place, and we were all excited to be more deliberate in our family time and spend more time with our friends. But in one night, it felt like all that progress that we'd made literally went up in smoke. Like in the early days of our farm, we had to lean into our community for help. Joe and Becca offered their cooler and washstand, and we cleaned up and prepared to rebuild. When we got quotes back from local contractors on how much it would cost to rebuild, we realized how little our insurance would cover. Money and food just started showing up at our door. In just a few weeks, we had gotten over $30,000 from a GoFundMe campaign and customers at the farmers market giving us $100 tips. It was once again an amazing feeling to feel so much support and loved. We were shocked at the outpouring, but really, I don't think we should have been. The little community that we have and are continuing to try to build together and tighter really is the most special part of our little story. We have these three Christian farm families, Joe and Becca, and my nieces and nephews right next door, and Bill and Ellen Orton, and my four godchildren just down the road. What felt so right from the beginning of starting our farm that most people thought was a little crazy was that we knew we couldn't do it alone. We needed our farming neighbors, Joe and Becca and Bill and Ellen, not just for spiritual and moral support, but also for borrowing machinery, building space, and knowledge. For example, it really couldn't be a better situation for me learning how to farm, knowing not a lot, to have Joe right next door who grew up vegetable farming, and he was pretty much available all the time to answer all my dumb questions. We really are forever indebted to Joe and Becca for sharing their space, their time, their knowledge with us. We couldn't have done it without them. We have learned how utterly dependent we really are. We also couldn't have done it without Bill and Ellen. If they hadn't added another dynamic and fresh blood to our very small community, there probably would have gotten so intense to the point that I joke about this, but there probably would have been a few murders or two by now. I partly say this because Hannah and I are obsessed with British BBC murder mysteries right now. I kind of imagine, you know, murder scenarios all the time now. But we have some English connection. You know, if you ever produce a BBC murder mystery, I've always thought our farm would be a great setting for that. You know, keep that in mind. But yeah, so that's all I have for kind of this wide angle snapshot of our homesteading journey. There's a lot more stories to tell, but now I want to do a quick slideshow of some pictures, and then I don't know how many of you saw the little blurb write-up that I did, but I included this Martin Luther quote about the apple tree, and I have a few thoughts about that, and then I want to open it up for some discussion on that. So I don't know if everybody saw this, but this is the aerial photo of our farm. This is our building site here. This is the driveway that we had to save up to put in right here. But yeah, it's very rolling around us, so we just pick these mostly level spots to do our little vegetable plots, and most of the in-between spaces is pasture and hay ground. So this picture is the oldest picture I have, and this is when Hannah first went to work at Joe's dad's farm. And this is when Joe and Rebecca Schwinn, and they met, and that was the beginning of what started the chain of events, where Hannah came to work and we met and started our family. This is pretty close to the time when we first met, so that's what we look like back then.
Same shirt,
Daniel? Is that my same shirt?
Probably.
That would have been awkward. This is how I pulled up the day that I met Hannah. This is my means of transportation. This is how I commuted out to Margot's farm. And this is before I bought the truck, of course. So I had the puppy. No, I think I had the truck at this time, too. This got better gas mileage, 60 miles to the gallon. That's Frankie. That's how I won Hannah's heart. So another story that I didn't tell is we thought it would be really fun to start farming with horses in the beginning. And that didn't last very long. This horse was amazing. This horse, Peggy, was a really bad horse. She was completely obstinate and would not do what we told her to do. So we had bought them from an Amish friends and we sold them back to them. This is the little end of the shed where we built the little apartment. It was our little, we kind of had, this is the kitchen, the living room, sleeping for me and Hannah, loft for sleeping for the kids. That's all it was. It was only 9 feet deep. It looks big here, but it's literally only 9 feet deep, half the size of this room. We did build a greenhouse off of the apartment, which basically we treated as part of our house, which was nice. I think that's the only way we even lasted as long as we did in that apartment. But this was where we started all of our plants for the growing season. This is my dad, Jack, who's here tonight, and Paul and Anders, they're little. My brother Eric and I, this is just to prove that I can play guitar, yes. This is Anders. It's kind of I kind of think of this as the farm face, you know, the kid farm face. Pretty much what they look like all the time. It's me and Anders, not on our farm. Anders and Paul, this is a little mechanical potato planter that we have. This is the greenhouse, we kind of set it up as a eating place too, and we had guests. This is Bruce. He's looking for his tape measure. This was the starting the framing of the house. See me up on the. This is the truck. That was a very important part of the story. Had to have the truck to get the puppy. This is inside framing the house. This is a very. We use these mono trusses to make it a real open floor plan so we could span. Wouldn't have to have supportive rooms. This is what it looks like in the winter on our farm. This is what Minnesotan kids do in the spring. They don't wait for all the snow to melt before they spend time outside. That's what you gotta do. This is the stove that we splurged on. That's kind of the centerpiece of our living room. Some chickens, some sheep. Frankie. Reading to the boys, very important part. And the fire. This is the proud of the firewood pile there. Hopefully the boys are gonna be doing that soon. Proud of some lettuce there that we pack in. This is a cousin picture, the Schwen. You can tell the Schwens by the red hair. Is that, what baby is that?
Abel.
Abel, baby Abel. Very well-weeded carrot patch there. Bill, appreciate that. House at night, at dusk. Some serious work going on there, some serious hoeing. Tried to host a lot of potlucks back in the day, not doing so good at that anymore, but green beans there? A green bean?
Yeah.
Green peppers. Beans and peppers. Kids spend some time on tractors, that's some heirloom tomatoes, that's kind of one of our signature crops. This is what your hand looks like when you've been picking heirloom tomatoes for a long time. Shallots, some peppers. Those don't look like our peppers.
Yeah. That's not ours. Yeah.
I think this is a stop. Sorry about that. I was way too perfect. This is Anders picking up some potatoes. This is holding an entire 24 bunches of kale. Is that impressive? Have you seen this picture? Bill picks a lot of kale. This is an example of some of Hannah's flower stuff that she's done. She's really amazingly talented. This is the Orton family, missing a new one. There's now a little Andrew. That's Mary, Molly, Isaac, Ellen, and Bill. It's the house in the winter. This is our new, Frankie died, unfortunately. This is our new puppy, Charlie. Very cute. This Anders sucking maple sap out of a tree. Hannah, very proud with her new cooker that I made for her in 1 year. Maple syrup cooker. Some lettuce starts in there. It's a hoop house, unheated hoop house. This is our view from our porch to the east, which I love this view. I love the oaks there. They're nice, big, old oak trees that we were very excited. It was the one thing that came with our property that wasn't just a cornfield. So we were very excited about these oaks down here. Some spinach, some lettuce, salad mix. Oh, there's our newest addition, Samuel. Big eye, he's got Hannah's eyes. This is more of Hannah's front of the house flower stuff. Okay, this is the new shed after we rebuilt from the fire. This is still kind of in construction, but this is Joe Schwen and I playing pickleball. My normal pickleball partner is here tonight, Jake. But it's actually a lot. This is still in construction. Now we have like the full really nice floor, and you know, it's quite a bit better, but you know, why not have a pickleball basketball court, pickleball. This new shed very much fits our family so much more than the old one did. So in that way, it's been really amazing. These are all the cousins with their Grammy, Hannah's mom from South Carolina, visiting. Some of Hannah's flowers on our deck. Another little yard flower thing. This is when Samuel was a baby. A friend took a picture of us on the, notice the wood pile, slab wood. Samuel, our youngest, his obsession is machines. I think kids kind of start with machine obsession and then they kind of move into other things. But like, for example, Abel, who's the next youngest, he was obsessed with machines and trucks, but now he's like bringing up bugs to me and being like, look at this little bug I found. I'm like, oh, okay. All right, so that's the end of the slideshow there. So yeah, I just wanted to go back to that, the quote of that I put on the thing. It's, there's kind of two variations of it. The one is, if I knew tomorrow that the world would go to pieces, I would still plant my apple tree. Or the slightly different version that I put in there. If I knew that the world would end tomorrow, he says, I would plant an apple tree today. So there's no written confirmation that Martin Luther actually said this, actually, but it's been credited to him for a long time. And as a lifelong Lutheran, I feel like I can say, maybe he said it. To me, it definitely sounds like something he would say. And it's just, I think it really speaks to some of the things that Hannah and I have, some of the theological questions and spiritual questions that Hannah and I have grappled with over the years. And, you know, the first thing that stands out to me when it says that he would plant an apple tree, I think it's just such a great illustration of, you know, the biblical call to action as Christians, that Jesus tells us we're not just to sit around, bury our talent in the ground, and wait for him to return. We're to do things like plant trees. Luther was really big on vocation and the priesthood of all believers. We plant seeds, we work the ground, we do what we do for Jesus' glory and for his kingdom. We're called to action. We're called to the action of submitting ourselves to live in a way that he lays out for us in the Bible. And when we're doing the things that we know are being true to his way, like working and keeping his good creation, we do it knowing that he has promised that our work really does matter and that it will carry over into the life to come. But saying that he'll go out and plant an apple tree, I like how Luther is refuting the idea that we should just kind of pass the time until Jesus comes back and the world just burns up. And I think this is where the wonderful tension that's built into the quote is. It doesn't say that Luther would run around like a crazy madman passing out tracts and trying to save as many souls as he could in the next 24 hours before Jesus comes back. He also doesn't say he's going to make this huge elaborate plan to plant thousands of trees, like he would go out and rent a huge tractor and a mechanical tree transplanter and plant as many trees as he possibly could so it looks like he's a great environmentalist or something. The implication and the tone of the quote is more relaxed and it's playful. The way he puts it, to me, makes Luther sound extremely confident in the faith that things will play out at the end of the world just like his Lord Jesus would said they would. It shows that as a follower of Christ, he's been long growing that relationship so that he's been trained to trust his word, Jesus' word, and his promises completely. He's seen too much of the beauty of his good, of God's good creation and his love, that he had a sure and certain hope of how this world would end and how it would be made new. And that's kind of the final thought I want to close with, that maybe part of what's so important about interacting with nature in a real way, that's a real relationship, like gardening, like a back and forth, is that it would teach and train us to know in a deep way, to trust the creator of such an amazing creation. And the goal there is to have this trust, not just in some intellectual way in our heads, but in a real physical way that's been trained into our bodies by touching soil over and over again, and feeling the life that's ready to burst forth from that soil. It's like the difference between being told that a Honeycrisp apple is really sweet and then tasting and really knowing that it's sweet. For me, getting in touch with nature and the land hasn't been an experience of just being blown away by the beauty of bird songs and sunsets, although it's been that too. For me, I think it's been the joys and struggles of taking on a calling, a vocation that I feel very committed and strong about, that calls for a long obedience in the same direction, to borrow a phrase. Sorry, I lost my place here. And to be able to do that calling in such a way, to have a close connection with God's creation, for me has been such a blessing and a privilege, because I believe it's trained me to have eyes to see the fingerprints all over creation that all point to the great creator and sustainer of the world, Jesus. Like daffodils that pop up in the spring, so many things that I see in nature seem to point to the resurrection. Nature truly is a wonderful thing. It can be so glorious that we can even be tempted to worship it. But as wonderful as it is, it's also limited. You can worship and love nature, but it can't love you back. The Bible says that the Creator God isn't abstract or detached. In fact, the whole climax of the Christian faith is that God became a man who entered his creation and infused it with his love and his blessing. So I love that we don't worship some abstract God or some abstract way of living. We worship a man who loves us and who loves his creation so much that even after we became his enemies by rebelling against him, he came down into this creation, into a barn with hay and sheep. He came to pay the price so that we and all creation wouldn't burn up, but we would be redeemed and be made new. I'm going to close with this great quote from Andrew Peterson's book, which I love, and he says all the time, that Jesus isn't going to make all new things. He's going to make all things new.